Thank you very much. It is a great privilege to be with you, and I'm stunned that I'm allowed to participate in the Cambridge University Festival of Ideas. I have no academic background or achievements, and so in some sense it's inappropriate, and I am in some ways largely unqualified to speak to you. But I have a couple of ideas that I would really like to share with you this evening. As Jonathan said, there is a book, and generally presenting the material in the book takes 6 hours, and I have 1 hour. So I'm going to speak rather quickly, and I do apologize for steamrolling through some ideas. You can get the book. I'm not trying to sell you the book. A week from Saturday, the book will be free as an e-book on Amazon. If you go on Amazon and you put in the title as ebook, it will say, put it in your basket, and then the charge will be zero. And so you're welcome to have the book as an ebook free. You don't need to buy it. Well, of course, you're welcome to buy it, because you can underline there is an advantage. The book is called Three Theories of Everything, and it's a book about comparing worldviews. It's a very simple book. It has three circles, and if I had a flip chart or a whiteboard, I would be drawing three circles. So draw them in your mind. Three empty circles, and they represent absolute worldviews. Not relative worldviews, but absolute. When I was a little boy, I asked questions like, how high is up? How far is far? How small is small? I think most young children ask these kinds of questions. And it comes in the expression, why, until you're quite frantic about it. But we need to know where we are. We need to know the final circumference of the reality in which we exist. We need to be able to place and identify ourselves. And children are very busy with that. Later on in life, we despair, and so we stop doing it. But I would recommend go back and be a child again and keep asking these kinds of questions. An absolute worldview is a category that is so large that all of the particulars are contained in it with no remainder. It is a theory of everything. And as I have thought about it, it seems to me that there are basically only three. I'm open to suggestions for a fourth one, but it seems to me that there are basically three, and we'll call them 1, 2, and 3. And we'll put subtitles to call them monism, which is one, dualism, which is two, and trinitarianism, which you don't find in the dictionary, but it's an excellent word. I recommend it to you. 1, 2, 3, monism, dualism, trinitarianism. All human beings have certain things in common. Some obvious things, like we all breathe air instead of water. But some things that you might not think of immediately, we all complain. And unless the reality we live in is perfect, it is right to complain. We should complain because something is wrong. We suffer in a variety of ways, and we complain about suffering. And we want to know, why do we suffer? What causes this suffering? And is there a solution? The three worldviews have some things in common and some things that are quite different from each other. And one of the main things that they have in common is a similar understanding of the history of reality. They each understand that reality had a perfect beginning. These worldviews are not necessarily religious, although we largely associate them with religious, but an atheistic astrophysicist will believe in a perfect beginning of a singularity, and then the Big Bang, and then anomalies begin. But there is a perfect beginning. So most human beings believe in a perfect beginning, but we also realize that we suffer. So reality as we experience it is not perfect. And we want to know what was reality like when it was perfect so that we can know what is wrong. If we don't know what health is, we cannot identify sickness. If we don't know what good is, we cannot identify evil. If we don't know how things should be, we have no logical reasons to complain about how things are. We can just say, oh. There are, I believe, three basic theories about this, and they are 1, 2, and 3. The first one is monism. Do not confuse it with monotheism. Monotheism is the belief in one God. Monism is the belief in one, in a perfect unity. And this idea is very old and very powerful, and it began probably in India thousands of years ago when people looked around themselves and observed and experienced that there are very strong unities in reality. There is one earth and one sky, one sun, one moon, one human race, one cycle of day and night, one cycle of four seasons. There's a very powerful unity. And there are diversities. Different kinds of people, different kinds of weather, different experiences that people have. And they experience that the unities are stable and faithful. And the diversities are unstable and unfaithful. And so they reasoned. It was a rational conclusion. It wasn't an irrational conclusion. They didn't have these experiences because they were eating funny mushrooms or because they were possessed by evil spirits. They were normal human experiences of the reality in which we all live. And they concluded that the original perfection is a perfect unity. And that the reason we suffer is that the illusion of diversity has come into the human consciousness as a nightmare. Truly, all is one. All is Brahman. All is Buddha nature. All is Tathata. All is however you want to name it in Sanskrit or Japanese. There is a perfect unity in which there cannot be any suffering, any alienation, any loneliness, any competition. You see how attractive that is. The New Age movement, which is now the Old Age movement, picked this up with the big slogan, all is one. You may have heard this. It's a very powerful bumper sticker. All is one. If all is one, you are God. Maybe that sounds okay to you. However, if all is one, you are me. That might not sound so good to you. If all is one, it's not a game. You are the moon. And you are all the stars. Because all is one. It is a theory of everything. If all is really one, and everything is truly unified in a perfection, without suffering and without alienation and without competition, then our experience of ego consciousness and alienation is an illusion. It's as a nightmare. What is the solution to a nightmare? You wake up. And so that is exactly the solution in this situation. Enlightenment or awakening, Kensho Godo. Satori, however you want to name it, it is an awakening from the illusion nightmare of individual ego consciousness in contradiction and competition with other ego consciousnesses into the perfect reality of Krishna consciousness or Buddha nature or Tathata, which means undifferentiated quality or possibility. Then beginning with this idea, people developed over centuries various therapeutic methodologies to help people to realize ultimate consciousness as a unity so that they would no longer suffer. they would no longer live with the fear of annihilation, with the fear of unbeing, with a fear of competition and being beaten. They would no longer live with all of these fears and anxieties because they would realize the perfect unity of the all. And this idea can be taught to children. You teach the child, there is a drop of water, and the drop of water has problems. He's lonely. He fears evaporation. He's frustrated because his function is for fish to swim in it, and he's too small. So what is the solution to the drop of water? He goes back into the ocean and becomes one with the all and all the other brother sister drops of waters. And then he laughs at evaporation, and he's never lonely, and fish swim in him, and he is fulfilled in unity with the all. Do you see how a three-year-old child can learn these things? A three-year-old child can learn almost anything. They're much more intelligent than we are. You just have to speak in the ways that are practical and material for them, and they get it. So these powerful ideas can be expressed very simply and very pragmatically and very graphically so that people grasp them and can come to a lively hope in a kind of salvation. So we are lost, we suffer. We need to be healed, we need to be restored, we need to be fixed, we need things to be better than they are. And any system that works toward that is a system of salvation. We are saved into a true reality where we really belong, where we have our true identity. Each of these worldviews believes, as I said, that there is a perfect beginning and then something went wrong and now we suffer and we need to make it right again. In the first one, in monism, it was realized very early on that the average person does not actually awaken. They die in their illusionary condition. They die in the nightmare. And so the doctrines of reincarnation became obviously necessary. That there needs to be more time in order for the soul to realize enlightenment and to awaken into the perfection of the all. In the West, reincarnation has a very good press. It's thought of as a positive thing. You get another chance. Maybe next time I'll have straight teeth. There's hope in reincarnation. But where reincarnation was developed as a doctrine, it is the worst curse. Because you have the cycle, the wheel of life that turns, and you are born into suffering, and then you die. And then you're born into suffering, and then you die. And the goal is to stop reincarnating, to be stabilized in a perfection of awakened, realized consciousness. To be incarnated is a terrible curse. And this wheel is a very important symbol. It is the flag of India. It's not just something that's lost in history. It's very alive and present for us today. So various therapeutic methodologies have been developed, and I would love to describe them to you in detail, but I cannot. We don't have time. They developed meditation and various kinds of meditation, of changing your consciousness, of quieting yourself so that you don't experience the tensions of relationships. They developed yoga, which means union, which is a vast life-inclusive program. Now, we think of hatha yoga, which is the yoga of standing on your head in a pretzel or whatever you think of, but that is one part of yoga. There's also jnana yoga, which is the yoga of the intellect, bhakti yoga, which is the yoga of devotion, karma yoga, that is the yoga of work, and raja yoga, which is the yoga of meditation and transcendence. You cannot escape yoga. If you wash the dishes, karma yoga. If you take a walk and you walk rhythmically down the street, hatha yoga. If you read a book, jnana yoga. If you're a Christian and you sing a hymn or a praise song, bhakti yoga. It's a comprehensive system, and the goal of the system is to produce union, yoga, to tie things together, to make connections for things. And another therapeutic methodology is mantra, which is taking words that have meaning and repeating them until they become a vibration, a shruti, as you would say in Sanskrit, or probably also Hindi. I'm sorry, I don't know my languages. You repeat the words until they become a vibration, and the vibration gets finer and finer and finer until it becomes the vibration of the quanta, or of the electrons changing orbit in the atom, in which condition you vibrate in the same way as all physical matter in the cosmos vibrates, which is a big step toward unity. Now, these therapeutic methodologies are, in fact, therapeutic. If you practice them, you will experience improvements in your life. They were not designed by masochists. They were designed by people who wanted to do and be better, and they are therapeutic. If you do these practices, you will experience better sleeping patterns, more concentration, more relaxation, less stress, better digestion, better exchange of oxygen between the blood vessels and the cells. It's really therapeutic. Also, if you are Christians and you meet people who are monists, who are basically Hindus and Buddhists, you may be surprised to find that many of the people that you meet are more intelligent and more pleasant people than you are. And that may be quite a challenge to you, but this has been my experience over and over again as I've met monists. And my thought is, well, in some ways I have a lot to learn from you. I am a Christian now, and sometimes people ask me, is there anything that you have retained from Zen Buddhism? And there are a few things, and the most beautiful thing to me is something that is actually in the Bible, but most Christians ignore it or even despise it. And that is the importance of the ordinary. In Zen Buddhism, the ordinary is special. And if something is absolutely ordinary, it's absolutely special. And when I look in the Bible, I see, yeah, the Christian life is ordinary. The basic things of life is not special. It's not the pilgrimage and the vision and the power and these kinds of things. It's just the stable, ordinary things of life. Treasuring, digging in the garden, cooking food, inviting people, sharing things, serving people. The ordinary things of life are the basic things, the things that give order to our lives. The special things don't give order to our lives. They thrill us like a carnival ride. They're not wrong, but they're not the basis of life. And we lose touch sometimes with the basic things of life by concentrating in our achiever market share society on the special things of life, the flashy, the showy things of life. And the Zen Buddhists are militantly ordinary. And I continue as a Christian to treasure that and to wish that Christians would learn this from the Zen Buddhists. There are in Buddhism a great variety of forms and practices and traditions, and they can be very different from each other. Now, I am from the Mahayana Zen tradition of Buddhism. And there are various things about that tradition that might be unintelligible or unrecognizable to Theravada, Lama mystic, Tantric, Pure Land School, Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, Nichiren Soshu, the various kinds of Buddhism, might not really recognize parts of the other forms of Buddhism. And I have seen that people from the various traditions of Buddhism tend to say our form of Buddhism is the original true Buddhism. Now, as if those of you who are Christians can sympathize with this, because I know people who think God is a Baptist. But we know he's Anglican. So, you see, we can't say, oh, you're not unified. We can say, yeah, we sympathize a lot. Let's be friends. You know, you're not unified. We're not unified. We have a similar experience of life together. Let's have a friendship about this and think about how do we manage, rather than to say, oh, poor you, you know, you have this problem and we're so good. No, we're not, actually. We have our own difficulties, at least as much. Zen Buddhism, because I was a Zen Buddhist monk, I can tell you that Zen Buddhism actually is the original true Buddhism. it's very special in the sense that the Zen Buddhists are not actually monists. They are nonists. They believe in nothing. And I'd really like to talk to you about nothing for a couple of minutes. It's not a negative nothing. It's a positive nothing. It is a pregnant nothing. To illustrate, we can say it is possible that it will rain tonight. That possibility is real, and it is nothing. Everything that is possible. Can you think of something that is not possible? Is God possible? Is the devil possible? Are you possible? I know your parents tell you you're impossible, but it's not true. You are possible. There is nothing that is not possible. So possibility is the mother of everything. Because possibility is before something actually is, it is possible. So possibility is the nothing that is pregnant with everything. And in the Zen tradition, we would say Buddha is possibility. Buddha is not the fat guy painted gold in the restaurant. That is one symbol among many of Buddha. There are standing Buddhas, sitting Buddhas, lying down Buddhas, young Buddhas, old Buddhas, fat Buddhas, thin Buddhas, all different kinds of Buddhas. And if you have a restaurant, what kind of Buddha do you want? You want the fat laughing guy painted gold because it inspires your customers. But that's a gross reduction of Buddhism. We mustn't think we understand anything about Buddhism by looking at the statue. Although if you are a Buddhist, the statue might be really helpful to you. Buddha, as the Mahayana, as I understand Buddha, Buddha is possibility. That would be the bottom line to me. So when you realize Buddha nature, you realize possibility. And when you chant the sutras, at the Heart Sutra. It's beautiful. The English translation is, "Hear, O Sariputra, everything is nothing." Beginning with the nothing of the five senses and moving through the nothing of the six levels of consciousness. Reminds you of the Gospel of John, doesn't it? It's a really strong start. It's not a game, it's a description of reality. It's very, very deep and very powerful. And when you chant as an enlightened person, you swallow and vomit out the universe with every syllable because you have realized the possibility. And it's therapeutic. Things will change in your life. If you do mantras, things will change in your life. And mostly you will like those changes. In Zen Buddhism, we say, if you see the Buddha, kill him. That means if you think absolute reality is outside of yourself and you need to relate to that, you must destroy that idea. You mustn't see the Buddha. You must be Buddha. And you must not become Buddha, because you always are Buddha. You must only awaken and realize Buddha nature. Now, for you Westerners, I've taken you outside the sandbox to play. I've had you color outside the lines a little bit. I hope you've been wearing your seatbelt. So because of time, I have to stop with the first circle. I would love to tell you more and move on very briefly to the second circle, partly because of time constraints and partly because I don't know very much about it. We'll just briefly look at the second circle. It's dualism. People a long time ago, perhaps in China, observed and experienced that reality has opposites in it. There's light and dark and hot and cold and sharp and dull and male and female and wet and dry and up and down. Everywhere there are opposites. And they experienced when the opposites are in balance or harmony with each other, life is better. But if there is imbalance or disharmony, we suffer. If the weather is too wet, we suffer. If the weather is too dry, we suffer. But if there is a balance, life is better. Now, they also did not have these experiences and observations because they were eating funny mushrooms or indwelt by evil spirits. We all have the same observations because we live on the same planet and we have the same kind of eyes and senses as the ancient Chinese people who made these observations. And so they concluded logically, the problem is not logic, the problem is the basic paradigm. And a lot of Western people, Christian or otherwise, when they hear Asian philosophy, they think, well, that's illogical. But it isn't illogical. It is a logic that functions very nicely in another paradigm. And the logic that you use functions nicely in the paradigm that you have. So it isn't a question of telling a person you need to be logical because they might be more logical than you are and more consistent in their thinking. It's going to be a difference in paradigm that you have to deal with, in basic model, in absolutes that you have to deal with and ask which is the more livable and various other questions about it. So the people in the second circle realize that they suffer because of imbalance and disharmony. And so salvation is in restoring the balance. And restoring the balance involves various therapeutic methodologies like macrobiotic diet, feng shui, the hexagram, the I Ching, the Book of Changes, various kinds of things that were developed that are very effective for building and maintaining a civilization and an agriculture and an economy and a civil service. These things were developed in China and turned into a magnificent society with problems, of course. It's not that any of these societies didn't have problems. No one has arrived at perfection yet. And this is basically the second circle, the dualism. We have opposites, and they need to be functioning in harmony and not in conflict or imbalance. Now, I have some difficulties with this second circle, and one is it may not be absolute. It may not cover everything. For instance, what is the opposite of a river? That's difficult. But even more difficult, what is the opposite of time? There your brains begin to smoke, yes. I have to bring time into balance and harmony with its opposite. I'm not sure. Maybe a Taoist or Confucianist philosopher could help me with that, but presently I can't really work with that very well myself. Also, in a dualistic situation, the one thing you cannot have is victory. Because if you have victory of one thing over the other, the imbalance increases. It makes the problem worse. There must be harmony. And you must finally realize that Luke Skywalker is Darth Vader, and then the Force is with you. Just to mention a popular expression of some kind of dualistic solution to something. Now, I have to move on to the third circle. In the third circle, which is Trinitarianism, We're going to approach it in two ways. We're going to approach it in the way we've approached the first two circles, by observing reality as we experience it and asking what might be the source of this reality that we experience. This we could call natural theology, which is a very valid process. You examine the creation and you learn something about the Creator. And the other way we're going to look at it is to begin with the Bible, which is revealed, if it is true about itself, from dimensions other than space and time, revealed into space and time, things about truth that we cannot discover for ourselves. And then we're going to look, and that would be revealed theology. And then we're going to see if they belong together or if there's a conflict. That's going to be our process. And the first thing, I would start with where we started in the first circle, with unity and diversity. In the first circle, the original perfection is only unified. It's monism. In the third circle, when we experience unity and diversity, the Bible tells us that the original perfection of reality is both perfectly unified and perfectly diversified. There is one God and three persons. And it isn't a diversity that unifies, and it isn't a unity that diversifies. It is originally both. Which means that neither unity and diversity or diversity are the cause of suffering. We suffer in the context of unity and diversity, but the cause is something else. Then rushing on to form and freedom. We experience forms in reality like gravity and electromagnetism and thermodynamics. They're the basic forms that gives shape and structure to the reality that we inhabit. And within and because of those forms, we have freedoms. And outside of those forms, we have death or chaos or both. So the form of gravity makes me free to walk across the floor. If there were no gravity, this motion would continue and I would float and spin, and very soon I would be dead. I would be totally free, and I would be dead. I'll give you a little equation, which is politically incorrect in a postmodern world. It is total freedom equals death. Total freedom is freedom without form, unconstrained freedom. Total liberty, which is a very high value for many people, and particularly in the postmodern world. Culture and worldview, but total freedom equals death. There has to be form. If you want to fly and you climb up on top of the church and say, I will be free, and you fly, well, you will not be free, you will be dead. But if you examine the forms of aerodynamics, thermodynamics, metallurgy, jet propulsion, etc., you will be able to build an airplane and fly across the ocean. A tremendous freedom, but in the context of the forms. So if that is our situation and experience, what is the original perfection in the biblical revelation? It is a three-person God who has form and forms, and within the context of those forms, freedom. The persons of God are not clones of each other or copies of each other. They're quite diverse. They're similar and diverse. And the diversities can in some cases be opposite. For instance, it is the form of God the Father to command and to send. It is the form of God the Son to obey and to go. Opposite. But the Son is equally God with the Father. He is not a junior partner, apprentice God waiting to qualify for divinity. He is fully God, and he obeys, and he goes. You see, that doesn't fit our ordinary economy of Alpha and Beta people. Jesus would be less God than the Father in our understanding of personal relationships and life. But in the biblical reality, the one who obeys is equally divine, equally original, equally true and real as the one who commands. So there is a hierarchical relationship, but it's of form and function and not of quality. Do you see how that works? So we have in God form, and within the form of the different functions of the persons, freedom. And the big illustration I think of is in the Garden of Gethsemane. The Son was chosen and committed himself before the universe was created to come into the creation and to die to save it. Then there was the incarnation, and Jesus is here, and the moment is coming. And he came into the Garden of Gethsemane, and he realized, I do not want to do it. This is my form, and I do not want to be faithful to this form. And so he prayed, Father, if it can be any other way, let it be another way. And it wasn't a casual prayer, because the blood came out of the skin on his face and ran down onto the ground. It was mega stress to be faithful to his form. When he was faithful to his form at tremendous cost, then he was free to be God and the Savior of the world. If he had been unfaithful to his form, the universe would disappear, because the God who made it would no longer be there. So in the ultimate beginning of reality, in the biblical worldview, there is form and freedom. And that is why we experience form and freedom in the creation. And the form and the freedom in themselves are not the cause of suffering. We suffer in connection with the form and freedom, but the cause of suffering is something else. Objectivity and subjectivity is something that we experience. So this table is objectively here. And the objectivity of it does not depend on our point of view or our attitude. So some of us might love the table, some of us might hate the table, some of us might wish with all our hearts that the table were not there. But if we would all walk through this part of the room, we would all have a similar experience. We would bump into the table because it would be there. We see the table from different points of view. There is a subjectivity as well. So when I see the table, I see that it has two legs from my point of view. How many legs do you see? So you see a bit differently than I do. Well, you're obviously wrong, you see, because my point of view is the right point of view. I see the top of the table, and probably none of you do, but I can testify the table has a top, even though you don't see it. You can believe it by faith that the table has a top. I mean, you can trust me or you can trust your prior experience, but you don't see the top. So in subjectivity, you see less than there is. The whole table is there, but you never see the whole table. You see part of it. You see less than there is. And we each see different parts of what is there, but the whole time, the whole thing is there. When I see the table, I see the table of my chemistry professor in high school, and I see Mr. Corbett. You do not. You cannot, but I really do. And my vision of Mr. Corbett is not false. It's real. It's a part of the reality that we share together. We all see memories, associations when we look at the table, and they're all real. They're not false. They are subjective. So we see more than there is. There is what is there. We see less than there is, and we see more than there is. And the less and the more are real. The subjectivity is real, and the objectivity is real. One thing that I really treasure about postmodernism is that it has restored subjectivity to truth. And modernism rather eliminated it. Modernism wanted truth to be fact, and for truth to be that which can be expressed mathematically and encyclopedically. And the postmodern view has restored subjectivity to the truth. Now, I love that. I treasure that. I'm a little worried because objectivity seems to be being eliminated a bit. And then that worries me because I think we really do need both the objectivity and the subjectivity. What does the Bible say about God? It says God is three persons. The original reality is not a cosmic gas cloud of love or a mechanical energetic energy cloud or a singularity, if the Bible is true. It is three persons in community and communication among themselves. God is in community among himself. So you have the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. The Father does not change. He is faithful. The Son and the Holy Spirit view the Father from different points of view. They each view him perfectly because they are God. But what they see is slightly different from each other, which means that those differences are perfect, which means that God's image, human beings, Christians, do not need to be clones of each other. We should, in fact, have different points of view and different experiences of life. We shouldn't be cookie-cutter clones of each other, all living in the same way, which I really love because I'm not caught in some sort of cookie-cutter prison. So we experience objectivity and subjectivity because in the original perfection of God, there was objectivity and subjectivity. And these things are eventually going to lead to the idea that there is nothing new. There's nothing in the creation that is not in the Creator. That reality does not become more complex because the starting point is fully complex. And then the result of the starting point, the creation of the Creator, is complex. But there's not new elements. Everything is in the original perfection. And we won't be able to cover it all. There is personality in our experience of life. I experience myself, I experience other, I experience relationships, I experience a variety of points of view. Most psychological models of personality are a description of the individual. The biblical model is not that. The biblical model shows personality and identity as being beyond identity in relationships, fundamentally. We can see in the creation account that God said, "Let us make man in our image." So there's a conversation, us and our. And then Adam was created, and God said, "It is not good." Because Adam cannot say us and our. He can only say me and mine. So the image of God is not there yet, because the image of God is them, not him or her. When Adam was alone, he was aware of himself. He was aware of his environment. He had an effect on his environment. He named the animals, and he was not good. So personality is more than identity. It is in relationships. Because God is a personal, relational God, the image of God is personal and relational, not only self-contained and identified. So the center of the identity of Adam was not in Adam. It was in God and in Eve. But that's not a new thing, because the center of the identity of Jesus is not in Jesus. It is in the Father and the Holy Spirit. So then the human beings created in the image of this God are similar, not self-contained, but interdependent, complementary, needing each other for identity. Do you see how the realities correspond there? We experience dynamism. Things are not always the same. There's sequence before, during, and after. And the Bible speaks of there being a dynamism before the creation. There are two matrices of sequence in reality. You know, a matrix is like the movie. It's an atmosphere in which things happen. The matrix of tea is water. Tea happens in water. The matrix of sound is air. The matrix of email is cyberspace. It's an atmosphere in which things happen. So the matrix of sequence in space is time. Things happen in time, or they don't happen. The matrix of sequence outside of space is eternity. God lives in eternity. And there is an interface between time and eternity. But they are separate matrices of sequence. Eternity is not infinite time. Which means that every point of time is present to every point of eternity, which makes prophecy possible. And at the end of time, there will be a conflation of time and eternity, and there will be one matrix, and we will be together with God. But the reason we experience sequence is because outside of the creation, there is sequence among God. There is conversation. There is before the speech, during the speech, after the speech. There is choosing. There is before the choice, and after the choice. There is sequence, but there is no time. Time is created. I'm working with the question now. You don't have to join me in this question. I'm working with the question, is eternity created or not? I haven't finished with that one. If anyone has any ideas, please speak to me. Is eternity created or not? God lives in eternity, that is clear, but is it created or is it a part of God's original situation? I don't know. But I know that time is created and that it is a reflection of the dynamic matrix of eternity. So you see another correspondence, revealed theology and natural theology. Then we experience needs. We need to be warm and wear clothes and eat food and breathe air and drink water. But more deeply than that, we need to be seen. And we see this with little children who all day cry, "Daddy, look!" And if Daddy doesn't look, the need is not met. And the child is damaged. And that describes all of us. And we need to be seen and we need to be heard. If I speak, I need someone to hear me. Even if they don't agree with me, I need them to hear me. And we see this with children. Before they speak English or Swahili or German or whatever it is that their culture speaks, they speak. And they are not heard. And they are enraged in agony because they are not heard. Well, you've seen this. You've seen this with children. They speak and they're not heard. And it's very, very hard for them because their need to be heard is not met. We also need to make a difference. Where I have been and lived and worked, it shouldn't just be the same as if I were never there. I need to make a difference. I need to have an effect. I need to be significant, signo facto. I need to make a sign that can be read by others into the future. And we see this with little children. They pile up the blocks, voila, difference. And they knock them down, voila, difference. Sometimes it's most inconvenient. I mean, when they get mommy's lipstick and paint on the wall, it's different, but it's not so welcome by mommy and daddy necessarily. But you see, we need to make a difference. We need to make a mark, and for, to see that mark, and for other people to see that mark. And we also need to be wanted. We need people to say, come, be with me, be with us, you are wanted. And we all know how much we suffer when that need is not met. Where do those needs come from? Are they the result of sin? Do they come from the devil? I don't think so. I think we have those needs because God has those needs. You may never thought of God having needs before, but having the needs is pure joy to God, because the needs are the basis of trust. And trust is essential for love, and God is love. If I say, I trust you completely, just drop dead any minute, I don't need you for anything, I don't really trust you. I only trust you if I actually need you. So if God is love and there is trust, then there are needs. The persons of God need to be seen, to be heard, to make a difference, and to be wanted. And that is why we have those needs. Not because we're sinners, but because we're made in the image of God and we reflect Him. Now, here's my little picture of God. Each person of God empties himself to meet the needs of the other two. Love is an atoning sacrifice. Atonement means that we're able to be together. We're separated and we're able to be together, or we're able to stay together. So each person of God, because God is love and love is an atoning sacrifice, 1 John chapter 4, each person sacrifices, empties himself to meet the needs of the others, which means that each person is emptied once and filled twice. And the filling increases exponentially until the power is so great that God says, let there be light, and there's a universe. And this power, the Bible calls love, an atoning sacrifice, a relationship, a trust. I empty myself freely, trusting that I will be filled twice. This is God. And this is the true image of God. Adam and Eve and a child living in that way, emptying themselves, trusting, living other-centered lives with a dynamism that is perfect. That is God's intention, that we would be like Him. But we're not like Him. Something went wrong. Adam and Eve became self-centered. The serpent said to Eve, you don't need to trust God. If you eat this fruit, you will know for yourself good and evil. You will be self-sufficient. You will be a liberated woman. And Eve thought, yeah, I could do that. And God could have a holiday, and I don't have to trust Him. And I certainly don't have to trust this lump of a husband who's sitting there. I can be independent and a liberated woman. So she ate it and she died. She didn't have a heart attack and fall over. She became self-centered and she imploded like a black hole in space. And the implosion was so powerful that no light escaped. She became darkness. And then she gave some to her husband and he ate it and he died. He imploded and became darkness and became self-sufficient and self-centered. And then they knew they were naked. They knew they were vulnerable because they realized, if I am the center of reality, who are you? And there isn't room in reality for two centers. So you are a threat to me. And we come into competition with each other. And then suffering began. So if the Bible is true, we are created in the image of God to be other-centered creatures. But we are, in fact, self-centered creatures, and because of that, we suffer. What is the solution to that suffering? The solution is that the Creator himself will enter into the creation and become part of it. Merry Christmas. And then, being the created and uncreated, man and God, immanent and transcendent, living in time, living in eternity, a unique situation, he did one thing. Typical God behavior. He emptied himself. Not for himself, but for others. Literally, drained of blood on the cross. But also emptied himself cosmically, being sacrificed in the heavenlies. He emptied himself for the others. And the power of that emptying, the power of that blood, makes it possible for the whole universe to be stabilized and remade. And it makes it possible for all responsible, significant human creatures to choose to receive the power of that blood into them and to become new persons, to be remade. We are dead as self-centered creatures, and the power of the blood of Jesus, this emptying of God into the creation, makes it possible for us to become new, other-centered creatures and live, and then begin to learn and grow and adjust into that new life in Christ. So there are my three circles. The first circle, the original perfection, is a perfect unity. We suffer because the illusion of diversity has come into human experience. The solution is to awaken out of the illusion of diversity into the perfection of unity. In the second circle, the original perfection is a perfect balance and harmony between equal opposites. We suffer because disharmony and imbalance has come into reality. Salvation is to restore the balance. And the salvific processes, the therapeutic methodologies of each of these circles are in fact therapeutic. Make no mistake. That's why they're attractive to people. People don't want to suffer more. They want to suffer less, unless, you know, there's a serious problem deeper down. In the third circle, the original perfection is other-centered. We suffer because we have become self-centered, and the solution is that the original perfection will empty itself in other-centered atoning sacrifice to give the power for us to become other-centered again. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alice. Very stimulating, very interesting, challenging. I hope you'll agree. Can you all hear me, by the way? Yeah? Okay. There is far too much in what Alice has just said for me to respond in any but a very simple way. So I'll take my most fundamental disagreement with him and see where that leads us, and just see how you, well, it's for each of us to explore in our own way how we respond to this. So I'd like to start by inviting you to notice how the soles of your feet are feeling. So how easy would you find it to put that into words? Not very. Have you got any concepts for how the soles of your feet are feeling? I suspect not. Well, I don't. I mean, I could say a little bit. I could talk about pressure and different bits of the feet. Very difficult. So what happens in terms of our experience as human beings is that we experience moment by moment by moment, many different things in the course of a day, and we survive and get around in our world by putting concepts on them. Now, the kind of concepts that Ellis was talking about are very big concepts in all three of his circles. And I would like to suggest that actually they're not different. These are just concepts. My experience is of the soles of my feet. It is as it is. It's what Ellis was saying, ta-ta-ta, which I wouldn't say is possibility, I have to say. I would say from a Buddhist point of view, it's thusness. It is just as it is. And that's true with all our experience. So if we think about how do we engage experientially with these bigger ideas, notions of God, notions of emptiness, what do they mean to us as people? Then I'll start with a biblical text. Be still and know that I am God, Psalm 46. What does that mean? To be still, not to have our heads full of the usual chatter, I this, I that, I'm angry, I'm scared, all these everyday thoughts. To actually be clear of all that, and that's what we as humans need to do in order to know that I am God, is the phrase. To have an experience that somehow gives us some knowledge, some contact with something that when we're outside that experience, we might put a label on as God. But when we're in that experience, we have no concepts. And this is clear in the Bible as well. God is beyond understanding. God is beyond concepts. We as humans can't conceptually get to grips with him. So it's only, but there is something about complete stillness, emptying ourselves of me, 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 in its subtlest forms. The nearer we get to that, the more we can have a sense of awe. And any of you who are religious, whatever religion, may well recognize those times when you've been a bit freer of that me, 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 and have had a bit more sense of closeness to something that's greater than any of us. So a Christian might say, in that stillness, there is a possibility of some sense of God. A Buddhist, a Zen Buddhist, would talk about emptiness. Emptiness to me does not mean, okay, I'm not a Zen Buddhist, I know something about Zen Buddhism, and Ellis probably knows more about it than I do. But emptiness to me does not mean possibility. It means, again, seeing the emptiness of all my thoughts about me, of all my thoughts about the world, seeing how I'm just constantly constructing that stuff. And I don't want to get into the philosophy here because we'll be here for several weeks, but to think of it in practical terms, this is an invitation as practice, as religious practice, to go to stillness. In other words, the whole philosophy of emptiness is actually about be still. What happens when you're in contact with that emptiness, or when there is, as you get closer to it, there is a sense of, so the human spirit in silence, in the presence of that for which none of us have words. In other words, the human spirit, the human heart is the same everywhere. God, whatever we mean by God, can not be different for different people. the experience of the Buddhist or the Christian or the Jew or the Muslim, in the end, has to come down to the same thing. We are simply putting different concepts on our experience. We are, in a sense, the longer I practice as a Buddhist, the more I find myself able to translate and go back to my own cultural background and understand what Christianity, or my own family's Jewish, what that's about. It makes sense to me because it's the same as what I'm doing as a Buddhist, just using other concepts, other tools. So why am I a Buddhist and Alice is a Christian? Am I not, you know, is he right and I'm wrong? Am I right and he's wrong? And I'm sure in this, you know, there are as many understandings in this church as there are people. And we each of us, of course, believe we're right at some deep level. And the problem, the great tragedy we face with this, the tragedy of a globalized world where we're constantly in contact with people of other faiths, other beliefs, is what you see in Islam with the Islamic State, where people feel that their religion has a right to, is an excuse for perpetrating horrors. It's what you see in Judaism, religion is an excuse for ignoring the well-being and the rights of the Palestinians. It's what you see in Christianity in Northern Ireland, or again, Christian support in the name of religion for what's being done to Palestinians. It's what you see in Buddhism, because I don't exclude Buddhism from this, when you see Sri Lankan monks encouraging the war against the Tamils because they said it was protecting Buddhism. These are why it's actually deeply important for us to understand that we're all talking about the same thing. It's also important because the conflicts that people get into in the name of religion put off many good people from any kind of engagement with religion at all. What we're practicing, we who believe, is deeply, deeply valuable to the human race. And we should try as best we can not to degrade it, not to make it unattractive to people who think and are concerned about some of the ramifications. So if we look, you know, why do I think I'm right to be a Buddhist? Well, I can look back in my own history, and I'd invite you to do the same. How did you come to have whatever beliefs you have at this moment? Whether you think of yourself as Christian, Buddhist, any other faith, or none. Was it your childhood? Was it people you met along the way who either attracted you to the religion or pushed you away from it? Was it, so it's our own experience that has conditioned us into being able to believe certain things and not believe others. And, of course, it's the time we've been born into. If I'd been born in England 100 years ago, I couldn't have been a Buddhist. So the particular form of Christianity, the way Ellis has spoken today, he couldn't have talked that way, he couldn't have thought that way 100 years ago. The way we engage with this that is beyond words is conditioned by where we individually come from, historically and as individuals. There's a Tibetan Lama in Cambridge, Ato Rinpoche, who has an image I find very helpful. There is one tree. In order to connect with that tree, we have to hold a particular branch. We have to be Buddhist, Christian. We have to be fully committed, as the Jews say, with all our hearts and with all our souls and with all our might, the central prayer of Judaism, the Shema. We have to be completely committed to our faith. But that commitment implies not saying that our faith is wrong and others are right, because that is actually demeaning and diminishing a faith which is actually about all of these faiths, about universal love and about letting go of the self here. So, thank you.